Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
So I hate when the spontaneity of our banter is ruined by technical issues. Because you know a cat story is only funny the first time you tell it. If it's ever funny at all.
It is, Paul. It is. I have to say that cats are always funny, and I even have a banter today about cats too.
I want to hear. Tell me about your cats, because my cat, I'm going to kill it if I keep thinking about it.
I have a unique skill to multiply. Can I say multiply cats?
Cats multiply pretty well on their own if you just leave them to their own devices. Yes. That's not a skill.
Okay. So imagine a friend of mine, she asked me if I can take care of her home in the village with two horses and two cats. So I went there on a Friday evening and I was supposed to be there for a week to take care of everything. And then Saturday evening, I hear something in the garden, like, you know, like a meow, like some, you know, like different noises. Yeah. So I went there and then I see that the two cats that I'm taking care of are fighting with other big cat. And then what I see, it's like, what the fork? There is like three other cats. And the funny thing was like those three other cats had the same colors as the two one that I was taking care of. So there were two gingers and one black. So I was just thinking for the first second, like, am I drunk? What is happening? You know, are those cats like, you know, just in my head? Like I see them, you know, multiply in a few different animals. And then I saw that they are just very small little kitty cats and that, she just gave a birth and now it was the time when she just started to show them off and to other cats. They were just jealous. So they've been fighting and yeah. But then I call my friend and I tell her like, you know, I know that when you left me yesterday, you had two cats. Now you have six. and she said like, I don't care. You have a week to get rid of them. Give them away to people, you know, to anyway, I don't want to see them. And she said, but you know what? I would like to have six horses. Can you do that? I don't know. Let's give a try. But no. At the end, there is still one cat to go. Two of them already found the house.
No. Not helping. Although, you know, what would be really funny, you know, my cats are both ragdolls. And they are dumb and clumsy. It's an amazing thing, if you haven't seen it, to see a cat behaving like a drunk dog. My cats fall off of things. My cats jump onto things that don't support their weight, and they fall on their backs. They do things cats are not supposed to. They knock things over. They can be walking on a shelf that is a bare, empty shelf that only has one picture on it. They'll knock over the picture. And so, on some level, I would just love for these cats to see just once a real cat, because he would be like a superhero to them. It would be like a human meeting Spider-Man. You know, what? You look like a cat, but you can do these things like jump onto a ledge without falling off of it.
Yeah, open the door. Really, really, those two cats were like amazing doing things, yeah. But you know, Paul, I really think that you should never ever leave me with your animals. Or maybe you should, because you want to get rid of them. Because the first Monday I was working and then I see some lady is just running in the direction of a house and I see her, you know, through the window. So I get out because I thought like, you know, something happened. And then she told me, your horses run away. And I'm looking, yes, they are not here. And I ask her like, but where they are? Do you know where they are? Yeah. They are next to the chapel. I said, okay, where is the chapel? You don't know where is the chapel? I don't know. I'm not from here. Can you just tell me? No, I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to call to the owner. I said, yeah, but they are on holidays. I can take care of that. I will go and go call, yeah? But then I just Google, where is the chapel? I put Google Maps pin on it. And I called to my friend and I told her, this lady, she's going to call you because she's not thinking that I'm capable of taking horses. They run away. They just knock the the protection thing, yeah, the fence, but I will find them. And then I found them, and the funny thing was that for the last 2 days, one of the horse was like having a problem with walking. Like I had to put ointments 2 times per day, give medicine, pet and everything. And then when she saw me, she was not sick at all. She was just running away, jumping, doing crazy things, really didn't want to go home. So yes, Paul, horses, animals, cats, challenge. Yeah.
You know, in all fairness to this woman, she only knew 2 things about you. You didn't know your way around and you lost the horses.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So, Paul, what are you doing right now when you are all alone at home during the self-quarantine?
I'm doing what I always do. Every summer, there's some time when I have to be home for work and my family is in the village. And so it's my straw bachelor period. And I'm a weird kind of straw bachelor. I do a lot of cooking. This is the time when I get to do all the things that my wife won't let me do. So I cook all of the crazy, like West African dishes and such, or really spicy foods that she can't eat, but that I enjoy. I cook really elaborate things. Mm-hmm. Experiment. Sometimes I'll do something like I'll try to master something and I'll just cook the exact same meal a different way every single day for a week so I can get it perfect before she comes home. But this time I went out and we already have a few smart bulbs in the house and we've got a bunch of listening devices. If you scream the right things, you can buy all sorts of things in this house. Luckily I've got a headset on, so you can't buy 1,000 rolls of toilet paper with the device over my shoulder, which I will not name because it'll start talking. So we've got all these smart devices in the house, but none of them are connected and work. I mean, obviously the devices which may not be named because they'll start talking will work, but but the smart bulbs and other things aren't connected because my wife hates them. And it makes sense. It makes perfect sense to me because I've been living with them for a while. I configured everything now. So I've got these routines, like every night, the lights dim down to 20% when it starts approaching my normal bedtime, just so I can start getting acclimatized. And I love the fact that you can just have the lights automatically dim. The light in the hallway, which is the brightest, goes from white to a kind of amber brown, which is really soothing. And every morning when I wake up, the first thing that I do when I wake up is I say good morning to my device, and all of the lights come up to 10%, so the whole house just lights up a little bit in case it's dark in the morning, and my coffee maker turns on, and I get 2 different news reports, NPR and Fox, which is a really jarring way to start the day, to hear NPR and then Fox. Because basically they say the exact same things in completely different ways. And so I don't believe either of them. And then the coffee's ready. But I totally understand why my wife doesn't like these things for 2 major reasons. One, sometimes you don't want the lights to be at 10%. You want the lights to be at 100%. Maybe you're bumbling around the hallway at night and you want it brighter. And so the automatic settings aren't really necessarily that useful. But the other thing, and this is the big thing, is when you're accustomed, you walk into a room, you want the light to turn on, right? Which makes more sense? Click and it's on, or asking some electronic device to turn on a specific light, and then it has to talk to you while it's doing it. And then a few seconds later, the light goes on. It's not actually a logical way of managing your lights, but it's fun, and I'll have to disable it all when the family comes home next week. How about you? You're home alone too, aren't you?
I will be home alone from Monday.
What is it that you do when you've got the whole house to yourself that you can't do otherwise?
In opposite to you, I don't cook so much because, you know, for Tom, the most important question for a day is like, what are we going to eat today? Yes. So then when I don't have to answer this question and I don't have to think about making, shopping and cooking, I feel relieved. You know, I like cooking, but like on the everyday scale, it might be a little bit, you know, tiring when you know that has to be something warm at noon and in the evening. So I would say this is the first thing that I just cook all for 2 or 3 days. And that's great, because when I'm not home alone, if I cook for 2-3 days, doesn't matter, it's gone the first day. So I just gave up on that idea. I can drink coffee at whatever time I want, because also Tom has the strict hours for coffee, like 6:30 and 12. And if you don't drink it...
Yeah, but you're drinking instant coffee.
Instant coffee if I don't drink at those two time zones, time spots, yeah.
Because that's when he makes coffee, right?
Yes, exactly.
When you're home alone, do you make real coffee or do you drink it?
Yes, I make real coffee at 11:30, you know, 2:30 p.m., you know, those crazy things. And I read a lot because it's... I'm constantly disappointed with myself with amount of reading. So when I'm home alone, I read and I write, like just sit down with a notebook, journal, and just write things down, all the self-reflection, all the thoughts or the ideas, because normally it's also kind of hard for me. I try to at least 2 times per week to sit down and write. The first is my work journal, and then the second, like the private life general, and then of course the 12 weeks year plan, but I constantly feel like it's not enough. I get a huge relief when I'm writing, my head is lighter, but I don't do it as much as I could. So yeah, most of those things. Yeah,
so speaking of reading, I've done quite a lot as well, and I speed read this book, because you know, unlike you, you'll read a book 2 or 3 times in preparation for this. You want to get it all over with early. You watch a ton of videos. My approach to reading books for the Agile Book Club is to read them as close to the recording time as possible. So it's the experience of reading the book and experiencing it for the first time is fresh in my mind. So I read this entire book in the last 3 days, reading about a third of it a day. And let's talk about it. I thought it was an absolutely fascinating book.
Oh, yes. So maybe you can start with your elevator pitch, because yesterday, last time when we were recording, you said that my elevator pitch would be in the elevator in like a skyscraper, like it's like 220 floors because it was so long.
Well, this is, I've got a short elevator pitch this time, which is unusual for me because usually I've got to do the whole setup and everything. But in this case, just because, and I think it's basically because the difference between this book and all of the other books that we've read is usually when we're reading a book about Scrum or about Kanban or what have you, it's about doing what you're trying to do better or about learning a new way of doing something. And in this case, this book is actually 100% novel. There are a lot of books on Scrum. There are a lot of books on Kanban. There's a lot of books on metrics. There's a lot of books on coaching. There is only one book on dynamic reteaming. This is a kind of revolutionary idea that one person had, and one person wrote one book that challenges the fundamental assumption we have, which is, you know, the classical Tuckman model that if you want to get a high-performing team, you have to keep it stable. And this book just says, no. I mean, it doesn't say no. It doesn't say that model is wrong. It says that that model is hugely limiting. And so for that reason, I would recommend this book to anybody who is either working in or responsible for an engineering department that has multiple teams and is going through any kind of a change or anticipating any kind of a change. If it's growing or shrinking or splitting or moving or maybe experiencing a global pandemic, then if they're coming at the way that they organize their work from the perspective that most people do, which is that stability is what we want in order to create high-performing teams, then this book will shake up that fundamental assumption and help them to see opportunities for doing things that they might not otherwise have thought possible. So it's one of those generic things. You know, like you do this all the time, where you say, I recommend this book to everybody. For different reasons, maybe. And now I'm doing it. I recommend this book to everybody who has never challenged in their own mind the idea that team stability may not always be in the best interests of the employees, the team, or the company.
Yes, Paul, I agree with you, and I would just extend it a little bit because there is something that has to be said. The way how Heidi did it, I love that she used the patterns, personal stories, all the interviews that she's done with various number of people to prove that dynamic routing might be the great thing for your organization, to show from different perspective, different size of organization, what are the benefits of change in the teams and how to do it. I really appreciated that she didn't base only on her experience, but she put so much time and effort with talking with people from all over the world, from New Zealand, UK, States. It was like really great thing for me to see such a different industries, different approaches all collected in one book. But also what I loved about the book is like there is a collection of other great books that you should read. So maybe when I'm home alone, I will just sit and order all the books that I heard about. I saw them at the conference and some people were recommending, but you know, you put the note in your notebook after conference and then you never open it again and then you forget. But now I know where they are. They are all in Heidi's book and I'm going to come back to reading definitely.
You know, it occurs to me that other than being obviously in the title of the podcast, we forgot to mention the name of the book that we're talking about right now. For those of you who are still lost, who might have just stumbled upon this podcast by accident, we're talking about Dynamic Reteaming, the book by Heidi Helfland. She has recently written a revised version of this book. I did not read the original, and so I can guarantee you one of the questions that I'm going to ask her when we interview her next week is, why did she write a second edition? What did she change? Because I don't want to read the first one after reading the second one and then compare them. I'll let her do the work for me. I'm really curious what is new in this book other than the many references to COVID-19. But hearing your elevator pitch, there's something that I want to say. One of the things that I really enjoyed about this, as an anthropologist who teaches workshops in grounded theory, is I really liked the idea that you can use grounded theory as a starting point for writing a business book. I've seen it used in anthropological and sociological research, but I've never seen it as the starting point in writing a business book. But to that point, there is something that I want to say about grounded theory for our listeners, which is that if you don't know what grounded theory in classic anthropological and sociological work, in order to make it feel like a science, because anthropologists wanted to be respected in the early days of anthropology, so they had to make the fuzzy stuff that they were doing look like science, you have to base your work on theory. And so people don't just go into the field and just tell stories. They actually do. But in classical anthropological and ethnographical research, you go into the field in order to try to demonstrate a theory. So you might be going in with some sort of economic anthropological theory. You might be going with a Marxist theory. You might be going in with a structuralist or a functionalist theory. But whatever it is, you're going into the field in order to try to demonstrate something based on the new data that you collect from the field. And that became more and more challenging as anthropology evolved and people started questioning objectivity and the possibility of objectivity. And also the fact that anthropologists going into the field are often going into completely novel circumstances where they do not know what they're going to find. And grounded theory is a really brilliant and innovative concept, which is that rather than going to the field in order to collect data based on a particular theory, you go into the field in order to try to discover a theory that explains what you see. And that's why it's called grounded theory. It means that the theory is grounded in the data. And it is a painstaking way of working, although what I like about it is it's very methodical. So you collect a lot of data, mostly qualitative data, interviews and documentation and this sort of thing. And then you go through all of it and you look for patterns. And the way you look for patterns is by coding, what they call coding. So as you're reading through this, if you see something that jumps out at you as being interesting, you'll write a word like chaos or fear or expansion or contraction or layoffs or whatever, things that just pop out as being meaningful to you. And then when you finished, you go through and you compare all of your codes and you start grouping them and you see where there are relationships between fear and change, for example, and which is the kind of approach that Heidi took to organizing this book. And this is the important thing to know about using grounded theory, and that is that contrary to what Justina just said, it doesn't actually prove anything. Grounded theory is not a way of getting at the truth, because if a different person took the exact same data and applied this methodology, they would come to different conclusions. They would use different codes, see different patterns. So it's not so much a way of discovering the truth in the data. It's a way of exploring the data in a sense-making way in order to extract insights from what seems like a huge pile of data. So that said, one of the things that I found a little bit troubling about this book is that it must have felt like an enormous amount of data, because I've done a lot of grounded theory work as a product owner, taking many, many interviews with clients and such, and feedback from our feedback forms and surveys and such, and then processing it all through a grounded theory approach. And it means reading through and coding hundreds of pages of documentation. But reading through this book, it probably felt like a ton of data when she was processing it. But my sense was that 60 or 70, maybe even 80% of this book is based on five interviews, because the same names kept coming up again and again and again. Rachel, Menlo, you know, there were like a handful of cases that just came up so many times that I wouldn't say that this book conclusively proves, based on a mountain of data, that there are precisely these five patterns. But it does prove that these five things do exist somewhere and they can work.
Now I scratch it as one of your takeaways, even though that we didn't announce it.
Well, that was one of my takeaways. My two biggest takeaways was you can use grounded theory to write a business book, and that changing a team isn't always bad, which is like the big idea in this book, is changing a team can be a good thing. So yeah, those are my two biggest takeaways. So I'll hand it over to you and stop.
Okay. So I will actually refer to your second big takeaway, which says that changing teams is not always a bad thing. And Heidi, she proves that, or she shows the benefits of reteaming in one of the chapters. And I think that it's eye-opener for many people, and it was the eye-opener for me too. Because my first reaction when I heard that someone is quitting or that someone has to be fired was like, how can we keep this person? You know, just to... don't change, just to not, you know, get the new person. But now after reading the book, I was like, wow, this is not so bad that someone is actually changing their career path. There's so many benefits, so many things that we can do about it. So when it comes clearly for the benefits that Heidi listed, the first one was that changing the team actually decreases the development of knowledge silos. So for example, we are used to having this team composition that Robert knows this, Anya knows that, and that's the current state of knowledge, and this is how we work. But then when there is a new person in the team and this person has to be trained, has to talk with different people, she automatically gets different knowledge. So those silos that might be built for years actually changed a little bit. The other thing is that it also helps to reduce the risk of toxic culture. And I've seen that mostly in the smaller organization when they were started as a team of friends, yes? And sometimes they also had some problems, issues with each other. And then when the next person is coming, they kind of had to stop because this person, you know, was completely outsider and they didn't want to get them into the Game of Thrones or something. Yeah? Or also this person could start asking questions that other people didn't ask because it didn't come to their mind that maybe that's something that they could ask, or maybe they were afraid of tired or anything like that. But when the new person comes and you have to explain something, then you start thinking, or for example, you change your behavior because the new person brings their own luggage, personality and behaviors. The other thing is that the idea of reteaming also helps to reduce the problems that we are having during retention, because if we allow team members to change their teams during the year, to go to different teams, to learn different things, we also reduce the risks that comes with retention, because we don't have this key person dependencies. We have the team that is equal when it comes for the state of knowledge. We have a team that it's not afraid to be changed, to change, because they are constantly in this mood. And also one more thing when it comes for benefits that comes from reteaming, it's also foster a whole team mentality, because we know that we as a team has to take the responsibility. We have the ownership and we are in the place and the power of doing changes in our team. So we are not afraid if something is changed because we were already in this position. Or for example, we are not afraid even to initiate the change because we were asked to do that. We are asked for the opinion. We are the part of the change. So from my perspective, these benefits of reteaming, they are not only applying when someone is leaving the company, even though that it, the first part of my takeaway was focused on that, but also with reteaming, when we give a team opportunity to do that, to move to different domains, to learn different things, and to just go with a flow of change that team needs, wants, and maybe ask for.
Yes, absolutely. So there are a lot of reasons why a change in a team might be beneficial. And I think it's fair to say one of the starting points in Heidi's thinking is something that we all have to acknowledge. And you pointed it out yourself about how sometimes people leave, sometimes people are fired, is that it's almost unhealthy the way we cling to this idea that teams should be stable when we live in a world in which they're not. And in fact, it's sometimes very unhealthy to think in that way, because I ran a software company for many years, and I got to tell you, you get really close to the people you're working with. It was a small company, so for most of the time that I was there, it was only 20, 30 people. And so I knew everyone very well. We were very close. People tended to stay for a very long time. So like our average turnover was over 5 years. Most people, if they stayed for 6 months, they would stay for 5 years. And so when they did leave, it was a big deal. And I got to say, there was only one time when an employee came and said, you know, I'm leaving the company, when I felt bad. And that was the only time that an employee ever left to go work for a competitor. Usually, when my employees wanted to leave the company, it was because they were starting their own company or moving to another country, doing something really cool that was really good for them, that was important for their careers. Some of them now are running very successful companies that they started right after leaving mine. And so when people left, they were my friends. I cared about them and they were going on to do really cool things. And so I only really felt joy. I came to think of my company as a stepping stone to a better life for people. And if I clung to this idea that stability has to be maintained at all costs, it would create a disconnect between my desire to do what's best for the company and my desire to see my friends do what's best for themselves. So reteaming happens, team changes happen, companies grow, companies shrink, people join, people leave. And if we live in this kind of dynamic environment, we should learn to use it to our advantage rather than just bemoaning the fact that we cannot have this ideal that we cling to.
Yeah. What was the, you adding something to my key takeaway, or was it already your takeaway? That's a question.
Are we keeping score still? Because I think you had about three takeaways in there.
Okay. That's true.
As you were going through your takeaways, I was marking off multiple of mine that I don't need to say anymore.
you know this game in ships?
Which one? Battleship? Were you?
Yes.
That... A7. You sank my battleship. That?
Yes.
Yeah,
that was my thought right
now. You know, no, what's going to happen here is the takeaways are not an issue because there are a ton of good takeaways from this book. But the way the book was written, great quotations were a little hard to come by. And I know exactly what yours are. So when we come to the favorite quotations, it's going to be a struggle to try to get a word in because there aren't that many to choose from. And I know all of your favorites. But anyway, the key takeaways. So one of the things we haven't said here is essentially what Heidi did is she talked to a lot of people about changes in teams. Like you said, from around the world. And what's good, what's bad, what's deliberate, what's accidental. And she identified 5 patterns. Teams tend to change either because you're slowly adding people, because the team's gotten too big and it needs to split up into smaller teams, because for one reason or another, you wanted a group of people to go off and do a special project, which she calls isolation, because teams are being brought together to solve a problem. Maybe neither team has the knowledge they need to solve a problem, so teams come together in order to increase their capabilities. And lastly, switching, which is when people move between teams, which can be a very deliberate and healthy pattern if done properly. So these are 5 patterns. The most common, obviously, you're going to see growth and splitting, whether you want to or not, because people come and go, teams grow and they get to the point at which they become unwieldy. These are patterns that are generally unavoidable over time. Some of the others, though, are very, very deliberate. And so the idea of having these deliberate patterns is when you see a problem, you can match it to a team structure pattern. So if the problem is something like, we've got this specific opportunity and we can't really pursue it using our current ways of working, then you might use the isolation pattern where you put together a team of individuals and they go off and work in a completely different way in order to solve that problem or deal with that opportunity. But the one that I'm interested in talking about, because it's a deliberate pattern that I think can be very healthy, can also be very destructive, but it can be very healthy, and that is this switching pattern. Because switching is when people move between teams. And there are a lot of reasons why you might do this. There are bad reasons to do this. And this is one of my takeaways, which she refers to as reteaming by abstraction. And this is what happens when your team structures are determined by managers who see people as resources in a spreadsheet. And I've worked in organizations like this where teams are put together by managers who have an idea about what a team should look like. A team should have 2 senior developers, they should have 2 front-end developers, they should have 2 testers, they should have an automation tester, they should have a project manager, they should have a product owner, and they should have an analyst like that. And all analysts are interchangeable, all front-end developers are interchangeable. And so if a front-end developer leaves this team, oh no, this team doesn't have a front-end developer, this team has 2 front-end developers, and so these people come to work one day and management has decided that one of the front-end developers from this team is going to join this team, so both teams will each have 1 front-end developer. But what it looks like from inside the team is this dude who used to sit across the hallway is suddenly sitting next to me, and I don't know why. And on the other side, this guy who I've been pairing with for the past 3 months and really enjoyed is gone. Nobody knows why. That can be incredibly disruptive because when that kind of thing happens, not only does it feel very disrespectful, it specifically happened to me. I came to work one day and found that I had been promoted. I loved working with my team and we were doing great things together. I came to work and found out that I was promoted. Another person had been hired to take over my job already. I found out that I lost my job by finding somebody else at my desk.
Oh my God.
And only later did I find out that I was promoted. And just to test the waters, I said, if this isn't something I want, can I go back and do what I was doing? And I got a very distinct no. No, we really want you to do this. No discussion in advance. It's very disorienting because it's hugely disrespectful to people, but it also disrupts the the relationships inside teams. Because as Heidi points out, if the person sitting next to you could disappear at any moment, how much time and effort are you going to invest in forming a relationship mm-hmm. with them? But the positive aspect of switching is allowing people to move between teams, ideally at will, directed by individuals or teams, gives them an opportunity to learn new things, to build relationships between teams. And this is something we talk about a lot in flight levels. One of the big issues that we have with flight level 2 systems is you've got teams that rely on each other, but nobody on team A knows anybody on team B, and they only communicate through management escalation and tickets in Jira. When you've got people moving between teams and somebody from team A needs something from team B, but they've been switching between teams and some of the team A people used to be on team B and some of the team B people used to be on team A, they're just calling up an old buddy who they know and trust to ask for help. It's a great way of moving knowledge and best practices or good practices or just ideas about different ways of doing things around. And it allows people to take more control over their careers. It allows people to deliberately go to a place where they can learn something that they want to learn. And what I thought was a really nice pattern for doing this is when it's reasonably frequent. Because if you just say, you can switch if you want to, but you have to get a bunch of approvals and there's rules and such, initially you can have a kind of stigma attached to switching, where people don't switch because they see an opportunity. They switch because they're fleeing a project that they don't like, or a team member they don't like, or a manager that they don't like. And if switching teams is perceived as fleeing something bad, as opposed to just playing the culture game as it's done, then it'll happen rarely and there'll be negative connotations. But if people do it frequently, then it becomes dynamic and flexible, and sometimes it's good. And if it's bad, you can go back to the way it was before with no stigma attached to the movements. And that kind of thing can be really tricky to instill in a culture that has never done anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of my rants. Little rant.
Uh-huh.
She talks a lot about how risky it is to play around with organizational structure and culture. But she doesn't talk very much about what to do to mitigate that risk. So I do appreciate the fact that there are explanations in this book for each one of these patterns about ways that it can go wrong
mm-hmm.
and preconditions mm-hmm. that tend to be associated with that kind of failure. But I think any time that you're deliberately dabbling in a complex adaptive system like a corporate culture, you need to understand that there are going to be unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences can be neutral, they can be good, they can be bad. And so having some kind of a system in place, a feedback system in place, so you can detect these unintended consequences, and having a kind of sense and respond approach to implementing change is absolutely essential. It's not enough just to know a few warning signs, a few ways that things can go wrong. But you have to understand that when you're changing the way people interact with each other and giving them the opportunities to interact in significantly different ways, you are dabbling in deliberate culture change. And mm-hmm. you have to be very alert to the implications of that. And I think the best idea that she has in this book for dealing with this is the idea of doing regular surveys, like monthly or quarterly surveys about how people are feeling about their teams, how people are feeling about their opportunities and such. And a shift in survey responses can indicate that there might be some unintended consequences of some change that has happened. But I also like very much the fact that she points out that if you're using surveys, there's two very important things to keep in mind. And that's not to do it too often, because people get exhausted with surveys, and to make sure that you're very transparent about how you're using the data. Because if people are doing surveys and they see nothing change, especially when you've got anonymous surveys, let's say you survey 1,000 people and 999 of them are happy and one is miserable. Mm-hmm. You might say, well, that's a great response. That's a great response. Our employees are generally really, really happy. But so you don't do anything. You just say, the result is that everyone's happy, and so we're not going to change anything. You now have one disgruntled employee who feels unheard, and you don't know who she is because it was an anonymous survey.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very clear about exactly what you're doing with these surveys so people don't feel. So that one person knows that they have some other recourse, and they know that they have been heard.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, everything what you said kind of leads to my other takeaway, to ask the team. Because so often we are in the organization when management is planning, as you described, Paul, exactly as you described, how many front-end developers, how many business analysts, how many designers has to be in the team. But what Heidi did in her book was to give examples on how can you ask the team what you can do, like those kind of job market that Liz Atkins was also describing, when I was reading now Dynamic Reteaming, I was also thinking about the job market that Klaus Leopold in Rethinking Agile described. How was it done in the company with 500 employees? Yeah, because for me, it was always easy to imagine that in the startup companies, small software houses, you can ask the team because there is like 20 people maybe. Yeah, so they can just create the teams based on the needs and you can vocalize everyone's needs and ideas. But for me, thinking about doing that in the organization 500 plus, it's just crazy. You know, there's also this risk. What happens if someone is not chosen? What happens if someone cannot find a place to work? Like, I really, you know, my dream for the next year, maybe for this year, it would be to take part in this kind of initiative, to see how you can do it, what are the risks, how to navigate those risks, how to organize it, because this is such a huge logistic initiative, but also a huge, huge responsibility because there are so many people involved. So I would like to see that, really, really. So if any of our listeners have this idea in a head and plan something like that, please let me know. I can be there for free just to see, you know, how to do it. But what I was trying to say, it's also, I think it's respectful to ask the team about their opinion. And I've done it even recently because we are looking for the new designer. And of course, I had the idea from the product owner, what kind of person it has to be. I had the idea also from the manager. I knew what was the person who left. So I had first the idea, who are we looking for? So I prepared the description. But then once I was reading Heidi's book, I was like, oh my God, I never asked the team with whom they would like to work with. So then after one of the daily, I just said like, okay, and now, you know, we are looking for this new person. Could you please tell me with what kind of person you would like to work with? What kind of skills this person should have? What is something that it's important for you? And they were shocked. They were like, you know, literally shocked because no one ever asked them. And I cannot blame other people that they didn't ask them because I didn't ask it as well. I was doing that in a smaller organization because I thought that, you know, in smaller organization, you cannot allow to have some kind of problems and issues with people because they are very visible when there are like 10 people in the company and one of them is not working with any other. But I was just having this kind of maybe stupid thinking that in bigger organization, those kind of, you know, little conflict issues kind of play out with the number of people. And I'm ashamed of that. I am truly. But I just wanted to make a note for everyone who is planning the recruitment process, looking for other people for your team. Please ask your team for the opinion because it's like playing in the playground. Yeah, you don't want to play with children that you don't like. You don't want to share your toys with them. So yes, just do it. Yeah.
And I think that's something that maybe hasn't really come across in our conversation mm-hmm. as much as it ought to, which is that this book, a lot like Lisa's book, this book has a lot of detailed practical exercises, things that yes. you can actually do. I didn't expect that because the first maybe 2/3 of the book was storytelling. It was telling stories of good and bad outcomes from following these various reteaming practices. But then about 2/3 of the way into the book, when she gets into the part about the switching, mm-hmm. like ways of switching, and when she gets into the part about, what was it called? What did she call it? Yes, calibrating, tools for calibrating teams. this thing turned into a recipe book.
Yes.
Full of exercises and ideas of things that you can actually do in order to form teams and in order to reform teams. So various ways that groups of people can collaboratively decide how to organize the way in which they organize themselves. And then once they've organized themselves into teams, various things that they can do. And there's some overlap with Lisa's book because Heidi and Lisa know each other. I think when we were talking to Lisa, she said that it's great that we're going to be talking to Heidi because they had worked together and they were peers at one point. And so they share some of the same stories. So there's a few of the same practices. But what I found really useful was two things. Number one, just laying out step by step the things that you can do and the ways to go about doing these things in order to help teams gel together or in order to help groups of people decide how to organize themselves. But I also thought the timelines were incredibly helpful because when I've seen change happen in an organization, it often is done, it's planned by a small group of people in a matter of hours. So I've been in meetings where six people decide which 20 employees are going to be laid off next week. And I've been in meetings where a handful of managers decides how five different teams are going to be formed. And they happen in an hour or a two-hour meeting. And just a second. Elsa, you're nocturnal. You are a nocturnal animal. Go sleep. Stop scratching on the door.
That definitely stays in the podcast.
Meow, meow, meow yourself. All right. So, yes, recording at home. I stuffed these guys. In preparation for this recording, I set up this little studio. My studio is a drying rack with a duvet thrown over it that I'm sitting underneath in order to try to avoid reverb and such, and a little tripod with my microphone and such. So I had all this set up, but I also played with the cats for 20 minutes with a laser pointer to try to exhaust them. And then I fed them an extra big breakfast. So they were supposed to just eat and sleep. Elsa, play with Galileo. He likes you. I don't. So I do love her. Just don't tell her that. Ah, goodness gracious. Elsa, do you want to say hi to our audience? Come here. Ah! Scratch, 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 scratch. What? Come here. Elsa, come here. Come on. Ah! You can say hi to Justina.
Hi, Elsa. Do you want a friend?
Isn't she beautiful?
Yes, she is. Elsa, would you like to have one more friend? Elsa, there is a little black mamba friend that you can have. If only you convince your owner, she's very cute.
Not going to happen. Not going to happen. So what was I saying before I was so rudely interrupted by this feline creature? Yes, indeed. There are, this book contains a lot of really useful, oh yeah, I was talking about timelines. So managers are used to sitting down with a spreadsheet and deciding on changes in a meeting. Sometimes there's preparation in advance. People come, they propose how things can be reorganized, and they agree to it in a meeting. And in all of these instances, when Heidi is talking about real cases in which 50 people or 100 people have decided how to organize themselves into teams, they took days, sometimes a week or more. And so I think it's very important for people who are thinking about doing that to have some idea of what they're getting themselves mm-hmm. into and what an appropriate amount of time is required for people to really think about and process how they want to change.
While you're reading Heidi's book, I had a lot of moments when I smiled because some of the cool things that she was mentioning that happened to her or happened to someone else actually happened to me. Like when she said about importance of inner roles beyond job descriptions, that different people in teams had different superpowers, let's call it like that, like team who was a juggler. And I remember that one of the questions that I was also always asking at the interview in one of my jobs was, what is the skill that you could teach us? What is your unique skill, hobby, something that you could teach us all? And it was really amazing to have this different approach for people who are hiring, that you don't only hire those skills that your clients are paying you for having, but you hire the people who can learn together, strive together to be better. So I smiled at that point too. But also there was one thing that she mentioned about creating history together as a team. In one of the companies that I worked with, in our corridor, we painted a history timeline with 100 dots and different events that happened in our life, in the company life. And there were events like new hires or that people left, new teddy bears that we bought, new clients that came, just kind of a juicy moment. And we had 70 dots that were already filled. And the funny thing that was happening, and it was funny and lame at the same time, and everyone was always saying, oh my God, Justyna, please don't say that. But whenever we were having interview and we were walking this person to the door, I stopped and I was saying, look at this history, our timeline. Yeah, you see, there is 70 dots already there and you have a chance to be one of them. Yeah, that was like the lamest thing that you could say. And everyone, you know, was like, oh my God, will she say, oh my God, yes, she did. Yes, she did. But you know, I think like what Heidi was saying in the book was great, that having this kind of a connection, not like a cult connection with your team, but I mean like being close to your team, being like friends as well, it helps you in working because you work better, you perform better when you work with people that you like. And in order to do that, you should hire the people that can like work together perfectly. And there is one thing that I had the problem when I work at this company, that sometimes some people were saying, oh, this is so childish that you are baking those cookies for your clients and sending them, you know, to United States, or that you do this and that. This is not the serious business. Yeah. But actually reading what Heidi was putting in the book was like, I was right. Those are the things that people are going to remember when you make like a gingerbread cookies in the shape of pandas and sending them to United States with a picture of the team dressed up in the Christmas outfits. Those are the things that really build the connection, that cement the relationship, not only with the teams, but also with a client, those business relationships. So just again, one note for everyone, all of our listeners, don't be afraid to go like a step farther when it comes with building relationship, because it really helps your team and helps your organization. Like the last cool thing, I know that it sounds like I'm bragging a lot, but it actually happened yesterday and it was also inspired by Heidi, because now in Poland and all over the world, it's this holiday season. Even though that the corona crisis is there, people are still traveling. But not everyone, because some of the people are afraid. So we decided with one of the teams that after daily, everyone whoever wants can make like a slideshow of their holidays picture. And that was so great, because we learned yesterday that one of our team members, he got engaged. And normally when you are not sitting in the office, you wouldn't learn those kind of things. But even though that we are living in this remote working, there are still ways that we can do to connect with team and work together better.
You know, interestingly, we're contradicting ourselves here.
Oh,
because no. In the, well, you know, Heidi and Lisa have a great deal of respect for each other, mm-hmm. and they worked together and shared a lot of ideas. I'm sure Heidi is very aware of this because it was in the Coaching Agile Teams book, but this is one of the things we talked about, which is in the last book that we reviewed, which is where Lisa pointed out that while it's important for a team to have good relationships, to work together, it can be a mistake to think that that chicken comes before the egg, that sometimes the best way to form good relationships is to be successful together, because it feels great when you're highly productive. And so both things can be true. People who like each other are going to be more productive, but also people who are more productive together will like each other.
That's true. Yeah.
I wanted to come back to something, to what you started out with, which is this idea that people bring more to the teams than just their role. The context in which she talked about that was very practical, and I really enjoyed it. She was pointing out that when a person is leaving a team, it's customary for them to hand off their role to somebody else. And usually that's thought of in very, very strict and practical terms. I'm a designer. I'm going to teach the new designer how to do design. And she was suggesting that people bring more to the teams than just their role. And so we should talk about that. So when a person is leaving, you should ask, what else does this person do that we're going to miss when they're gone? Does this person bring donuts? Does this person juggle? It might be something really important. Like, you know, every single time we're about to get into an argument, this is the person who is really skilled at diffusing it with a timely joke. And when she leaves, we're going to fight more.
Yes.
And so we need to do something about that. So I've got a lot more takeaways, but we've been going for an hour now, almost an hour. And is there anything that you just have to get out before we move on to the favorite quotations?
Actually, no.
I'm just going to tell our listeners there's a lot more to this book. There's a lot of discussion about pair programming. There's a lot of discussion about coding practices and quality practices. There's a lot of discussion about things like how to start up guilds effectively and get people communicating across different dimensions. So there's a lot in this book that we didn't manage to get to in this podcast. I don't want you to think that what you've heard is what you get. I still strongly recommend this to everybody who works in a company that has multiple teams, especially if you're undergoing any kind of change. You're going to find stuff in here that you're going to like. But now, let's get into our favorite quotations. And I'm going to start with your favorite quotation, Justina, which is that you can't make guacamole out of an unripe avocado. Sometimes teams and organizations aren't ready for change. Am I right? Was that your favorite?
Yes, that was my favorite. Okay, go over. Do you have a second one? That was my second favorite. That is literally listed as the first one.
Yes, I know what your second favorite is. Your second favorite is, in the absence of information, we make up stories.
That was my third. But yes.
Ah, okay. What is this, The Price is Right or something? No, what is it, Jeopardy? I can't remember. What is the game show where they survey people how they would answer a question? And oh no, it's Family Feud.
Family Feud. Okay, I will tell second, and it's long one. I had the short first and the short third, and the middle was long. So the bottom line to dynamic reteaming is this. Start where you are. Visualize your team structures, observe and get to know them, agree to pursue incremental reflection and adjust to your teams. Experiment and learn. Adjust your team composition accordingly. It sounded for me like Kanban.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mention that. There's a lot of Kanban stuff in this book, too.
Yeah, so that
and that might be a new addition, because I think when this book was written originally, Kanban was still rather young. So that might be part of the stuff that she added. But yeah, there's a lot of Kanban stuff. There's a lot of metrics, a lot of references to Daniel Vicanti's work.
Yes.
I want to throw out one more because I really, really like this one. And that is that you can't scale your company if it's comprised of a bunch of heroes.
Yeah, I remember.
That resonates with me. We had a whole conference with that theme. Remember the ACE conference, I think 3 or 4 years ago, the theme was, we don't need another hero.
It was. I was not there yet with the ACE conference, but I remember Minecraft character on the peak with,
Yes.
That was a great one.
That was a fun conference t-shirt.
Yeah, I don't have it. Doesn't matter. Okay, Paul. So what are we going to read next month? Because this time is your choice.
It actually wasn't my choice, although I wholeheartedly approve of it. This is a good time to tell our listeners that we have launched a Slack community for reading books together. And I've got a few ideas for this, a few reasons why I like the idea of having a Slack community. We've got enough listeners now to form a community and to learn from each other. But there's a few things we can do. We can read these books together. We announce the book a month before we talk about it. So all of you who want to follow along can read the book along with us and talk about it amongst each other. I've decided I'm not going to share my ideas about a book until I've shared them on the podcast. But after the podcast, we can certainly talk about it in the discussion groups. And also, we can talk about books that we'd like to read. and maybe even books that we're reading together that aren't in the podcast. And this is where the new one came up. I have had a book that is one of the best books about Scrum on my shelf for a long time. And I was kind of thinking about reading it for the podcast, and that is Scrum Mastery. But when I asked our early joiners to our Slack community what we should read next, somebody told me something I didn't know, which is that Jeff Watts, the author of Scrum Mastery, has just published a new book called Team Mastery. And I like reading new books because new books, we all have a lot of books to choose from, but new books are books that everybody has to decide whether to read or not. And so I contacted Jeff. He'd be happy to talk to us about it. And I'm really excited to read a book I've never read before. And both you and I, Justina, are now working with coaching agile teams. And so I kind of like immersing myself into these materials about teams. And I'm really excited to see what the author of Scrum Mastery has to say about team mastery. So that's going to be our next read. And it was chosen not by me, but by members of our Slack community. If you want to join the Slack community and talk about books with us and help us choose the next books to read, there will be a link to join the community in the show notes. But now, I've got a bunch of other things that I want to talk about. We are out of time for this podcast. We've gone pretty long. I think even after editing, this is going to be over a 60-minute podcast. But I've got a bunch of things that are going on that I think are that I want to bounce off of you. About this book, about some interesting conversations I've had about sharing and borrowing ideas in the Agile community. There was an idea that came out of this book and that reminded me of a story I want to tell about something I call P5, because the team called it Ping Pong Pomodoro Pair Programming. And I think it's a fun story. And I've also had some really interesting insights into connecting in social media and LinkedIn with other people in the Agile and Lean communities that I want to talk about. But I'm saving all of that for the after show. The after show is where, after recording the podcast, you know, Justin and I and our guests, sometimes we just can't stop. We've got so much on our mind and we do love talking to each other, but we don't want to create these huge, enormous, long podcasts. And we want them to be pretty consistent, not too rambling, but we've got other things we want to talk about, other things we want to say. And so those all go into the after show, which is a little more informal, a little more fun. We let our hair down. And the after show is available through Patreon to everybody who supports this show at the $5 a month level or above. So if you're interested in hearing what we're like when we're not producing a show, please join us for the after show. It's going to be a lot of fun. And for the rest of you, we love you too. It's fine. You don't have to help out. You don't have to help out. We're okay. But we just love you a little less. A little less. But we still love you because you're here with us and you're here for us and we're here for you. Thank you for joining us. Join us again in 2 weeks when we'll be talking to Heidi Helfand, the author of Dynamic Reteaming. Ta-ta for now.
Yeah, bye-bye.